Blog Talk Radio.
Found it. Radio Freemason. Another hour or so of opinion lubricated with some historical gems, hopefully of some relevance to the Freemasons of the world. It's a pleasure to have you back. Thanks very much for joining us today. This is the 3rd of August, 2014. 215th day of the year. Holy mackerel. Only 150 days left in the year, so we have to get on with it. Here in this part of the planet, we're enjoying something called a civic holiday. And this is Canada, after all, and in spite of what the politicians like to think, we're a huge place with some very distinct cultures doing quite well. Cultures that existed from the start of the country and before the country, and have continued to this day, even though there's been a despicable effort to rid ourselves of First Nations, a shameful part of Canadian history. The people that were here before European immigration still have a role and are making some headway with some of the dodgy outcomes of land claims that people signed off thinking that this was an unsophisticated culture that could be played by the more, quote, civilized representatives of government of the day. But that's not what the point of the civic holiday is. This holiday was known by different names in different provinces and municipalities. And in British Columbia, it's called British Columbia Day, and New Brunswick Day in New Brunswick, and Saskatchewan Day. And it's celebrated as Natal Day in Nova Scotia. It's not an official holiday, though. This is kind of interesting. In 1974, the government of Alberta declared, through the Minister of Culture, declared the first Monday in August an annual holiday to recognize and celebrate the varied cultural heritage of Albertans. And it's known as Heritage Day. And this gave rise to the Edmonton Heritage Festival. If you haven't been there, it's really something worth seeing. So 3 days of food, partying, dancing, and all kinds of interesting events going on. But in Ontario, back in 1969, renamed the holiday Simcoe Day as an honor to the first Lieutenant Governor of Upper Canada. And homage to that, he was the first promulgator of the Act Against Slavery. But a motion at the Ontario Municipal Association to extend the name province-wide didn't really go anywhere. Here's why. It's known by as Colonel By Day in Ottawa. So, Toronto, you didn't pay attention, did you? George Hamilton Day in Hamilton. Joseph Brant Day in Burlington. Founders Day in Brantford. McLaughlin Day in Oshawa. I like that. Alexander Mackenzie Day in Sarnia. And James Coburn Day in Coburg. Peter Robinson Day in Peterborough. And John Galt Day in Guelph. Mark DeLorme Day in Sudbury. And there's all kinds of others. So I've missed some. I apologize. So enjoy the long weekend, brother and guest. Play safe, but play. You know, this is the program that wants to help us all get off that treadmill of hedonic happiness, the treadmill that associates happiness with material gain. Replace that with eudonic happiness, the inner happiness, what I consider to be the meaning of the goal of Freemasonry, to seek happiness and to share it. We're a generous lot, and so are you. You're generous with your time. So I wanted to, today's theme is kind of interesting, and I want to bring out some things in it, and a big discovery, a discovery that I think will help us to feel very, it should help us to feel optimistic about the future of Freemasonry. You know, we see a lot of worrying and concern. This is really important to us. It's not like we're schoolboys here. It's important to us. And of course, when something's that important, when we have 40,000 of us, we're going to worry and be concerned. And may the great architect bless all of our middle management souls. We have an organization of 40,000 middle managers. Ah, I love it. I don't think we may be displeased, but none of us are surprised when we see a reaction to anything that goes on. How could you possibly get a consensus out of 40,000 people? I know. As long as we're still laughing at ourselves, I think we can combat the people that laugh at us. We're laughing with each other over here. Anyway, we've got an interesting program. That's enough about the civic holiday, isn't it? This is it's a good day. We'll have a little bit of music coming up from Mason. But I was reminded this week of the importance of understanding history. So for Freemasons, this comes as no surprise to you that anybody within the range of my voice will know that history is manna to Freemasons. It's an ineffable. It's the alchemy. It's the alchemist's notebook of Freemasonry. It was a startling piece of somebody. I was in a meeting somewhere and listening to a talk, and somebody was making a point about the advances that we have, the scientific advances, and misquoted a whole bunch of things. But I'm going to straighten it out here for you. The history, I think, is not so much about, when we think about, we live in an age of discovery, but I really have to question that and ask us if it's not more so about awareness. Because, and I'll give you a little example here. This is a nice little example, I think. This is about atomic theory. Yep. Atomic theory. We thought atomic theory was something that was relatively contemporary. Yeah. Yeah. We have to look back to Lysippus. And he's referred to, if you're a student of Greek history, that as the father of atomic theory. He was the first that we know of to record and conceive of the atomic theory. And he argued that the universe consisted entirely of atoms and void, a theory purposely contrived so as a contradiction to Parmenides' earlier view that voids are impossible. We're talking about voids that were alive in the, Parmenides was around 485 BC. Yeah, 485 BC. And he said that vacuums are a natural impossibility. And he said that nature abhors a vacuum, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Abhors a vacuum. But to atomic theory, we said all reality consists of hard, indivisible particles moving and colliding in empty space. So said Leucippus. Leucippus was a little earlier, actually, circa 450 BC. Interesting, isn't it? And he was reacting to denial of the void. I remember 450, 485 was the older, and 450 was the, you know, moving toward the common era. AD. So there you have it. If we've known, I guess, if we're thinking about the atomics, you know, atomic theory, knowing that piece about history would give us, certainly give us a leg up, wouldn't it? Yeah. A little bit of an advantage. The more we know about the history, the more it seems to connect with things that are contemporary, things that are going on around us. So I'll give you a few more of those interesting little facts that it'll make you seem, you know, like you're brilliant everywhere you go. Did you know that Google, the original name for Google, we all know about Google, the search engine, was Backrub. Mm-hmm. Did you know human taste buds are regenerated every 10 days? But you didn't know that, huh? Did you know before the Renaissance, 3/4 of the books produced in the world were Chinese? Yeah. Now, bear with me here. We're going to just play a little piece of music. This has to do with, you know, we wanted to sort of match the music that brethren would have been listening, would have been hearing in the period that they were writing. And for the longest time, the only music or entertainment people would hear was a troubadour, a singer, maybe with a lute or a drum. That was it. Maybe a flute, recorder. Medieval refers to a period between 1150 and 1400. This is the first period we can begin to be fairly certain as to how a great deal of music survived, that it sounded. The earliest, now this is not music for the church. We're looking at secular music from the 12th century troubadours. And they were singing ballads and things like that. But most notated manuscripts emanate from places of learning, usually connected with the church, and therefore they have a religious basis. It makes sense. Eh? But Gregorian chant and plain song, which are monodic, written as one musical line, gradually developed during the 11th and 13th century into organum, two or three lines moving simultaneously but independently. Organum was, however, initially rather stifled by rigid rules covering melody and rhythm. Don't want any of that toe tapping. Now, we certainly don't want anybody dancing. That's just out of the question. Men and women start dancing, the Presbyterians in the crowd will think they're having sex standing up. So we can't have that. Here's a little sample of what, we'll just go through a little bit of history here. We'll give you a little bit of a sample of music of medieval time. It's nice. Getting the idea? Yeah. That's medieval music. Music from medieval time. Vox vulgaris. It could be that, would we have seen, heard music from that period? Probably the likes of me wouldn't. Maybe the likes of you would. That's just the earliest time when we're starting to find Masonic ideas coming to the forefront. And I say Masonic ideas thinking in the broad brush sense of liberality, of equality. So here we want to listen to the music that was emerging in the day. At the end of the 14th century, that's the start of the Renaissance period, 14th century to 1400s to 1600s, 15th century. And that was, we saw a huge increase in a very large increase in freedoms, harmony, and music started to echo those freedoms. Still, mostly devoted to choral music is what we would experience. We, in the second half of the 16th century, we heard the beginnings of the tradition, which many of us really enjoy, the field of classical music. Gradually, composers moved away from the system of harmony, which had predominated for over 300 years, and still sounds somewhat archaic, eh? And towards the organization of their work into major and minor scales. Ah, black and white keys. Yes, the instrumental music came into its own for the first time, especially the keyboard instrument, the form of variations. Here's a little bit of Renaissance music. This would have been the music of the period of the writers of Freemasonry, I think. Get a little bit of an idea, eh? Yeah. See them. Different melodies have taken over, have been introduced, foot tapping tunes. But that's the music that the likes of us Freemasons would have been hearing. We generally are. What's written is generally more opinion that the workers, this fairly people that didn't have a liberal education, were part of Freemasonry. But generally, what's written about is people that had the access to knowledge, members of the intelligentsia, the elites, in a way. You and I today have access to education, to music, to elements of society that were that had a lot of barriers around them in the 17th and 18th century, 19th century. Those barriers were dismantled largely because of the growth of the mercantile portion of the population. In fact, those ungentrified people were accumulating great amounts of wealth, and this eventually confronted the mismanagement and poor management of the aristocracy, who became, in a way, dependent on that money flow from merchants in exchange for title and favor. Simplified version. It wasn't that long ago. It really wasn't. You put a little context around this. Think about Oxford University. Yeah, it dates from around 1096. It's older than the Aztec Empire. The Aztec Empire got started in 1325. It's funny how we tend to shuffle history, isn't it? We sort of mix it up, put it into this blender in our minds and have at it. I would have thought the Aztecs would have been, you know, pre, you know, maybe 2nd century BC, 10th century BC. So that fact was a little hard on me. Do you ever think about what we do, what we try to do in Freemasonry? So I'm going to put that into some words that might make sense. We can have a conversation around it. I'll call it a building. I like to think of building. But I'm often thinking today, as I get a little older, about building beyond a lodge. What we do inside a lodge is certainly not nearly as important as what we do with the ideas and the changes in our lives. Freemasonry is a lifestyle. And if we go through the motions, then that's what we pretty much amount to, pretty darn superficial. If we're a bit of a stump, this is where we separate out people and men of ability. So you can have rank, but unless you have a clue what that is, in the 30s they referred to as, what did they refer to them as? Peacocks? You know, you go through the motions and parroting, parrot masons. Could say the words, but really didn't have a clue. Well, if you're of a mind that you're thinking that there are men amongst us who should not be Freemasons, should never have gotten into the order, I want to ask you to reflect on something, brother. The principles of Freemasonry are not going to be injected into your mind and into your heart. They have to be welcomed into it. And Freemasonry is not simple and it's not easy. It's work. Mm-hmm. Or you really don't get anything out of it, I think. Here's what I mean. From when we're looking at the community within Freemasonry, we're going to see people that, you know, we shake our heads and wonder, or we may think, in fact, they may do the same with us and probably do, with you and I. We seem so different. Well, it's not always easy to see the common man in each one of us. We can do this. We're taught to, by the ancient charges, to respect one another, carry ourselves with some degree of manner. But when it becomes very, very hard, when politics rears its head, or some pettiness occurs, when we're offended, the principle of Freemasonry challenges us greatly. when we are on our back legs knowing that we are absolutely right, Freemasonry whispers to our conscience, is it possible to be right and wrong at the same time? The question. Freemason can answer it. Me? Of course it is. Of course it is. Right and wrong at the same time. And how do we resolve that? Well, Masonry sort of hands that to us on a platter. We have to think about the common good, about the harmony of a lodge. And to measure the depth of your training, if you can walk away with your feelings hurt, but walk away for the sake of the preservation of the harmonics of a lodge, even though nobody else knows your motivation. You're not doing it because somebody pats you on the back, but because you know it's the right thing to do. Then you're chipping the edges off the rough ashlar. Any of the easy stuff is just that, and anybody can do it. You think about that man. Remember that line, if you see a man? Well, think about being that man. What's he doing? He's going about his business, minding his own business. He's content. He's taking care of the things, his obligations. That means we have to, what, come to terms with our egos and come to terms with competition. Man, the competition, and you see it with some of the boys, it's fascinating. Only if you're bright, you always claim it's not competition. A Grand Lodge provides constitutional protection. You've heard me talk, we've talked about that before. Only a Master Mason, though, protects the landmarks. You know, Grand Lodge can go and say, this is the way it is. But really, that's we're getting out there when that happens. It's you and I and our understanding of the landmarks that is essential. If you haven't studied them, you've done yourself a bit of a disservice, but you've also saved something quite wonderful for your future. It's absolutely brilliant when you, and as you do start to read them, read the material that talks about 44 ancient landmarks. Here in our jurisdiction, we don't define the ancient landmarks, but there are a few that we use. But think about the 44, and it really does start to add some more color to the discussion. Landmarks. Charles Darwin hesitated 7 years to publish his work. Did you know that? He had the ideas before that. Darwin understood that his thesis on natural selection was radical. He also knew his peers. He knew as soon as he published, his life would change. Friendships and respect would be lost, and not just for him, but it would set a tone that would reflect on his family. His peers, they would isolate him, and he would be hurt by their smug mockery and ridicule. He could not then protect his own reputation and the good name of his family and be true to science. Right and wrong. Hmm? Darwin's history tells us a great deal about the cost of facts that challenge popular belief. Victorians, they were champions of shaming. Gee. Is that going around in the lodges and districts? Of course it is. But hindsight has moved Darwin off the blacklist that did occur. His science was defining. Today, it is still misquoted and manipulated to serve a sad, prejudicial agenda. When Charles the student first boarded the Beagle, he had no celebrity, no findings, no research, just a curiosity and talent for observation. Ship's captain liked to sit down with him because he was an intelligent young man. They could have conversation. We might say when he eventually published, he was ready to make the sacrifice, but that isn't quite the case. We're trying to make a noble step here, aren't we? Darwin had dithered. Science had moved on, and another researcher publishing a monograph that outlined his findings. So was it hubris that kept him moving? Ego? Competitiveness? We will truly never know. Decide for yourself if he was selfish, suppressing science to avoid the hypocrisy of peers. Would it be fair to think we escaped the same chemistry of shame and compliance? Have we not been part of our own process of discovery? Did we not build mind vaults of mystery and esoteria that watermark every page of Masonic history? What do we do with it but suppress it because of the knowledge that the reaction of our peers would be unpleasant? What do you think? Epictetus said, tells us that there is only one way to happiness, and that is to cease worrying about things that are beyond the power of our will. Do you know that? Yeah. When you are offended at any man's fault, turn to yourself and study your own failings. Then you will forget your anger. See, he's talking to us about balance. Is freedom anything else than the right to live as we wish? Nothing else. Here's a quote we often hear, and let's give the guy credit for this one. This one's from Epictetus. He was born in 55, and he died in 135. Old, eh? Yeah. It's not what happens to you, but how you react to it that matters. Of course, we're translating from Greek. All religions must be tolerated, for every man must get to heaven in his own way. And then he tells us, you know, to accuse others for one's own misfortunes is a sign of want of education. To accuse oneself shows that one's education has begun. To accuse neither oneself nor others shows that one's education is complete. Freedom is not procured by a full enjoyment of what is desired, but by controlling that desire. Only the educated are free. People are not disturbed by things, but by the view they take of them. So first learn the meaning of what you say, and then speak. He says, only the educated are free. Interesting man. Interesting man. So we had music at different periods. Music that went along with the different periods, yeah? And then we went beyond the medieval and the Renaissance, and then we went on to the Baroque. This is the kind of music I listen here is in writing or pulling together the ideas for Radio Freemason. That Baroque is the period generally between 1600 and 1750. This is when the 300 years of musical expression found a foundation. You know, from that period forward, the idea of the modern orchestra, along with opera, opera, that's that blend of acting and singing and music and emotional expression, intense emotional expression. So this is the time when the violin was replaced the viol. And the viola and the cello and the harpsichord were invented. Until then, until about 1700, old forms were still exerting themselves by in the music. But this is where we have the Greek music that we know as classical music. There was no such term as classical music in the day. But up until this period, choral music had been dominant, and composers were turning more and more to writing material for instruments and ensembles with a lot of color and variety. So this is where the so-called classical music, as opposed to popular music, gradually began to work its way into the very fabric of society. And this is where it was being played outdoors at dinner parties, scandalous, or special functions. And this is where we get the music like Handel's Water Music, you know, up and on, when the king is on the barge, going up and down every week. Yeah. On a purely domestic level, every wealthy lady would have a spinet to play. And at meal times, the large and rich houses would employ musicians to play what was popularly called Tafel music in Germany, and of which Telemann was perhaps the most famous. Here's a little bit of Baroque. At the start, the earliest, this is a refined form of Baroque. If you were listening to the originals, it was very discordant and, to my ear, terribly unpleasant. So this is sort of a refined form of music. This is, remember, now keep in mind the music that we've heard from the medieval and then the Renaissance, and this is Baroque. A little bit of taste, Baroque. That was music of the Baroque from the Netherlands, by the way. Who knew? Yeah, so you have a little, just a little sample. Yeah, just a little taste. Again, lubrication for the mind, isn't it? Music that helps us think and relax. It's funny. It's odd. The struggle was to, you know, for a long time, the average person wouldn't have had access to that kind of music. And then it was available to more and more people as time went past. It wasn't just the music of the privileged groups in society. I should talk one day about Shakespeare, because Shakespearean music was, or Shakespeare's plays were about bringing music bringing theater to the average person. And the Globe Theater had the sort of people would show up quite early and would be, you know, mulling around and reacting, and it was very loud and raucous. It wasn't this, you know, it wasn't like Stratford and Avon, or where we sit very quietly and look very thoughtful. This was almost performance art. And he was doing pieces on history, like, what did he do, Henry IV, and he did that in two parts, and then Richard and, you know, Macbeth. These are, now Macbeth, yeah, okay, he may have taken that theme from Christopher Marlowe, who was writing much earlier, but still. Shakespeare produced most of his work between 1589 and 1613. So our early brethren would have had access to that work. He wrote tragedies until about 1608. Up until then, that's when he wrote Hamlet again. Macbeth was a theme from Christopher Marlowe to King Lear, Othello. And then after that, he wrote sort of what's become known as romances, tragic comedies. The Romantics in particular acclaimed, they just thought Shakespeare was a genius, and the Victorians worshipped Shakespeare with a reverence that George Bernard Shaw called bardolatry. Don't you love that word? Bardolatry. In the 20th century, his work was repeatedly adopted and rediscovered by new movements of scholarship and performance. His plays remain highly popular today and are constantly studied and performed and interpreted in different cultures. So we think that he was born on the 26th of, April of 1564. Because there was no record of the birth, but the tradition at the time was for babies to be baptized 3 days later. And the baptismal records from Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire, England, was for the 26th of April. So we think that's why we think he was born on the 23rd. Funny, eh? He died on the 23rd of April in 1616. He was only 52 years old. Yeah. So there's a person that was bringing theater to masses. What's happened to that? What's happened to that? Now, instead, you think that we wouldn't have heard music, we wouldn't have heard singing. And I'm not talking about sort of the despots, and we've had that at all faiths. So you do away with various forms of entertainment as being ungodlike. All faiths have had that at one point or another in their history, I think. Is that fair to say? That's a pretty big statement. I'll be taking calls over that. But what the hell? I've been trying to clean up my language for obvious reasons. I didn't ever swear until I was, 13 years old. That's what the Boy Scouts taught me. Rather ignominious reflection. Swearing. Dostoevsky, you know, he wrote in Russian, wrote millions of words. He's well known in Russia. But he once said that everything in Russia might think or speak, that a Russian might think or speak, could be expressed with only one word. And that word was kui, or prick. This is the root of 500 others in one Russian dictionary. It's now banned from use in public under one of Vladimir Putin's puritanical ordinances. Along with a very few others, Dostoevsky's word is at the root of mat, the Russian language of profanity. Centuries of oppression, despair, and inventive drunkenness have gone into this language. The writer Viktor Orofiev described it in the New Yorker as a philosophy of life. Indeed, Russia would grind to a halt without its lubrication of the innumerable frictions of everyday life. Swearing. This will not happen. But Putin is trying to develop, stamp it out, but to keep it hidden. You know what Russians are really like. Let's just hide it. He stands for a new Russia that's built on repression of every sort. We raise instead two fingers to salute the Russian mat. The philosophy of life in Russia. There. What, two fingers? Make your own call. There's got to be somebody out there that's been to Malahide. He'll know. Devilish little things. And now for something a little more Masonic. This is from a little book that was copyrighted in Ottawa the 15th of November. Yeah. 15th of November in 1915. I was thinking it should have a little music in the background, but I think that's a little hard for some listeners for a lot of reasons, I guess. This is about the Mother Grand Lodge. Do you mind? And I believe it's part of the public record. So I do try and sanitize the program from things that are Masonic, from things that are public record. I'm having an awful time with the hypocrisy of all of this. This notion of secrecy and privacy have really become jumbled with Edward Snowden releasing millions of documents that have taught us that we are vulnerable to some very aggressive nation states that are hacking into our phone conversations and to our internet and to our email. You know, that ugly, ugly notion raises its head when we have these kind of ethical discussions. And it has since Greek time. It's part of humanity. If you have nothing to hide, why are you worried? You would sell one of the freedoms that a lot of good people fought for. You would sell it that cheaply? That's all you got? My Lord, what have we become? Wow. You've got nothing to hide. What are you worried about? Everybody should be able to, everybody. You don't need a warrant. Everybody should be able to snoop in everybody's personal, private matters. So you just wipe out thousands of years of history. The struggle. And you're doing it at a time when we're trying to keep in mind the sacrifice of what Margaret Macmillan calls the war that ended all peace, the First World War. So I say to you, and to those who claim that hacking is necessary because we'll find bad people, intrusion into my privacy is a violation of everything that I believe in. And if I can do nothing but honor the men and women who sacrificed given their lives for these freedoms over the centuries, is to stand up on my hind legs in front of at the expense of the mocking of my peers and say, this is not going to happen. Get out. Get out. Get out of that. Stop doing it. It's wrong, and you know it. Free people don't need government looking into their business. You can't figure out how to get criminals any other way by violating the privacy of free men. then we've got the wrong people in charge. Truth. In the 14th century, Freemasonry was a society or guild of operative Masons. So said A.T. Freed, past Grand Master of the Grand Lodge of Canada in Ontario. Was originally formed by a voluntary association of artisans for mutual benefit. It was afterwards taken under royal protection and granted many privileges, such as immunity from the statutes of laborers. In no essential particular did the societies of Masons differ from those of other guilds. It was a trade society and nothing else. It is true that men not operative Masons were members of the guilds of Masons and of all the guilds. But this fact is easily accounted for. In the first place, the sheriffs, city officials, and other government and municipal officers were required to be present at the general assemblies of the Masons as well as those of other guilds. And it is not improbable that they or some of them were enrolled among the members. In the next place, the employers of Masons, or the lords as they are called, and the architects who desire to keep in touch with the workmen, and the workmen would be quite willing to have their countenance and protection. The greater part of the buildings erected in those days were churches, cathedrals, abbeys, and other ecclesiastical edifices. And the ecclesiastical lords, then as now, desired to know what the members of the secret societies were doing. The Masons were quite willing to have their spiritual pastors and masters among their membership, and to benefit by the protection that membership gave them against the crown and the barons. But there was another and more effective cause for the acceptance into Masonic bodies of men, not operative Masons. All persons engaged in mercantile business or practicing any industry or mystery were required by law to form themselves into guilds or companies. Where in any town the weaker trades were unable to maintain sodalities for each, several of them united to form one guild, and were very few were engaged in a calling, they sought admittance into one of the existing guilds and were accepted on payment of certain fees or fines. On the one hand, the law made it incumbent upon them to be members of some guild, and on the other hand, such membership was of great value to them. Only members of the guilds were permitted to carry on business in the cities, and many privileges and immunities were given them by the crown. They elected aldermen and municipal officers. In fact, they were the electors of the town in which they lived. Thus, at the end of the 14th century, the date of the oldest existing Masonic documents, Masonry was a trade union or guild differing in no essential from other trade guilds. It had a charter from the Crown, was under supervision by officers of the Crown, and was governed by regulations partly framed by and satisfactory to the King's officials. Remember, 1300s. Its members, with those of other guilds, formed the electorate of the cities and towns and chose the municipal officials. Only members of the guilds were permitted to carry on business in the towns. Men, not Masons by trade, were accepted as members of the societies so that there were free Masons, or men who enjoyed the freedom of the towns by reason of having served as apprentices to the trade, and accepted Masons, or men who became members on payment of certain fees because they had no guilds of their own trade or calling. Rules and regulations of the government of Masons differed in no important particular from those of the other guilds. The apprentices were to serve faithfully for 7 years. They were to be zealous in the interests of their masters, to be content with their wages, to do no villainy with the wives or daughters of their employers or their fellows, were to be free by birth, no bastards, to have the proper use of their limbs, and were not to consort with evil characters. The like regulations with slight modifications applied to the fellows of the craft or journeymen. The masters
or employers were to be true to their lords, that is, those to whom they contracted to do work. They were bound to attend assemblies of the craft when properly summoned. They were to take only a limited number of apprentices, none for less than 7 years, and none that were bondmen. They were to pay apprentices not more than fair wages. They were not to take contracts without feeling assured that they could carry them to the completion. And they were not to supplant others in the work that they had undertaken. So you're not bidding against each other. If a traveling workman came to them for employment, they were to give him work or, quote, refresh him with money to enable him to reach a place where work might be obtained. All classes were to be true to the church, loyal to the king, obedient to the law, loving to their brethren, and charitable to the poor and unfortunate. They were to live honestly and reputably. The employer was to pay fair wages and the workmen to give honest work. So far as has been ascertained, there was but one ceremony of initiation. Whether there was any difference between the initiation of the apprentice and the reception of an accepted mason is not known. But between the end of the 14th and the beginning of the 18th century, many and important changes took place in the religious, legal, social, and industrial condition of the people of England. And these changes had a marked effect on the fortunes of the Masonic guilds. In 1536 and 1539, Henry VIII suppressed the monasteries and confiscated their money, their property, and all. And for more than 100 years, no more ecclesiastical buildings except churches were erected. The Roman Catholic clergy no longer had power over or interest in the building trades, and the clergy of the Reformed Church did not appear to have taken notice of them. In the reign of Queen Elizabeth, the statutes of laborers were repealed, and that monarch gave evidence of unfriendliness to all secret societies. Indeed, it appears that proceedings were instituted against Masons for frequenting unlawful assemblies. After the death of James I, Masonry fell more and more into decline. We know that lodges met occasionally and that they accepted men who were not operative Masons, but the lodges were few and the attendance at the meetings small. Be hearkened, brethren. Lodges were few and the attendance at the meetings were small. In 1646, when Elias Ashmole and Colonel Mainwaring were initiated at Warrington in Lancashire, there were but 7 members present. And in 1672, when Ashmole attended a lodge in London, there were 10 members present, including himself. The rebuilding of St. Paul's Cathedral and other churches and secular structures after the Great Fire in London, that was 1616, yeah, gave new life, and that was, what was the last plague before that, 1613, third plague, gave new life to operative masonry. But in the year 1717, the lodges of that city were few and feeble. Oh, falling apart? There's something new and remarkable. It is generally asserted that there were but 4 in the cities of London and Westminster. Huh. 1717. In the beginning of the 18th century, there was no general organization of Freemasonry, but if indeed there ever had been such, when a large building was in progress, the workmen got together and formed a lodge. In the majority of cases, the lodge died when the work was finished. There was no grand lodge or central authority of any kind to grant warrants. There was no grand master, as we understand the term. Anderson, Preston, Oliver, and other Masonic writers speak of Christopher Wren as having been Grand Master for many years, and say that in later years the lodges fell into decay because he neglected them. Undoubtedly, Sir Christopher was Grand Master over the Masons who wrought on St. Paul's Cathedral, and possibly over those who wrought on other buildings of which he had been the architect. But it may be remarked that if Sir Christopher ever was a Freemason at all, he was Grand Master long before he was a Mason. St. Paul's Cathedral was begun in 1675, and on the 18th of May, 1691, Aubrey, an English author, wrote that there was that day to be a great convention of Freemasons at St. Paul's Church, when Sir Christopher Wren and others were to be adopted as accepted brethren. Thus, so far as he was Grand Master at all, he was Grand Master for at least 16 years before he became a Freemason. In fact, he was merely the superintendent of the workmen. And to wrap it up, the condition of English Freemasonry then at the beginning of the 18th century was substantially this. There were four weak lodges in London and Westminster, and their members were operative and accepted or gentlemen Masons. There were a few lodges in other parts of England, but their number is not known. There was no Grand Lodge organization or central authority. Each lodge was absolutely independent. Masons met and formed lodges at their pleasure and left them to die when they had served out their term of usefulness. There was but one ceremony of initiation and but one degree. And if we wonder how that's possible, I think it's reasonable to think that today, all of the illusions aside, perceptions aside, Freemasonry is not the buildings. Freemasonry is the ideas. Freemasonry is something that's inside of us. It's internal. Freemasonry then existed before governance. Existed before constitution. Existed, you can think that with independent lodges, how would we determine any standard of ritual? Well, we wouldn't. Each lodge was free to, there was no notion of standardization. It was a mixed forest. Different things in different lodges. Diversification. Now, you and I can compare that to the kind of monoculture that we have today. Makes it sound a little bit grimy, doesn't it? The question is, did we give up anything? Really? Maybe with the modern era, we've tasked individual Masons to pass on the knowledge to the next generation by being students. Become the student of the craft so that you have sufficient bits of knowledge and collectively we can pull together the complete history of Freemasonry and pass it on to the next generation. One mind, one man couldn't possibly accomplish this. But together, we're very strong. We're a very noteworthy group of people. And we work hard. We work very, very hard. I'm going to wrap up the show today. Thanks for joining us. I hope you've found it a bit entertaining, a bit useful in some ways. I want to bring you a little memory. I've talked today about the First World War. This is a real short little song from that period. 1918. Just everybody thought that this was state of the art at the time. State of the art. Here, think the big handlebar mustache and Lord Halifax pointing his finger at us. You know, your country needs you. Here's a song called The Last Long Mile. And this is the historical recording from 1918.
must be 20 miles a day to fit me for the war. I didn't mind the first 19, but the last one made me poor. Oh, it's not the pack that you carry on your back, nor the Springfield on your shoulder, nor the 5-inch cross, the Clinton County door that makes you feel your limbs are growing older. And it's not the hike on the hard current high that wipes away your smile, nor the cost for the sisters that raise the blooming blisters. It's the last long mile. Someday they'll send us over and they'll put us in a trench, taking pot shots at the Britons with the Tories and the French. And someday we'll be marching through a town across the Rhine, and then you'll best we'll all forget these mournful words of mine. Oh, it's not the fact that you carry on your back, nor the Springfield on your shoulder, nor the 5-inch cross, the Clinton County door that makes you feel your limbs are growing older. And it's not the height on the hard current high that wipes away your smile, nor the cross for the sisters that praise the blooming blisters. It's the last long mile.
State of the art, 1918. Huh? Of course, they made a necessary sacrifice. There can be no other conclusion. No other conclusion. It's just really, really hard to reconcile. I apologize by referring to Lord Halifax. It was Lord Kitchener, wasn't it? Remember marching off, simpler times? Have we learned anything? We need to be better students, I think. Better students of history. And if we're waiting for other people to do it, get on with the job, we're going to be waiting forever. Now I'm going to wrap up the show today with a little piece from a real live, former live Mason, Irving Berlin. Irving, now he's born Israel Balin in Eastern Russia, right near the Serbian border in the Russian village of Tyumen. Think about that. What's the difference between somebody living in Eastern Russia and a songwriter, a famous American songwriter and Mason? What's the difference? One generation. One generation. He was one of eight. He had seven brothers and sisters, and his father was a person who worked processing kosher animals as prescribed by Jewish religious law. And Irving was also the cantor in their synagogue, and his family moved to New York. He was still very young. Moved to New York in 1893 to escape the pogroms, the purges in Russia. And he was at the age of five. He stepped onto Ellis Island, 5 years old. Can you imagine? Then he went to live in the Lower East Side. Perhaps they said at the time it was one of the filthiest places on the continent. And he was poor, and there was a Jewish ghetto, and it was, you know, just full of gangsters and legislators and merchants and professionals. This was not a very pleasant place to be. He was initiated into Moon Lodge. Yeah. And here's a little bit of his music, eh? This is the year he was born,
was the year that National Geographic magazine published for the very first time. Did you know that? And the very first African-American was nominated for president. Its first African-American. His name was a man by the name of Frederick Douglass. Yeah. And this was the year you have your Kodak camera. Remember that? The roll film? Of course we do. Eastman Kodak patented that. The very first roll film camera. So we're going to hear a little bit of Irving Berlin. What's not to like, eh? It's beautiful music. I hope you've liked the show today. It's been a pleasure to have you here. I look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, keep an eye on each other. We're all in this together. Commit as many acts of random kindness as there is in your heart. As there is kindness in your heart. See ya.